Hi, I'm Josh Kimmel. This is number 0291 of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0291. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we have a retro interview with a star who is no longer with us. Barry Morse, best known as Lieutenant Gerard, on TV's The Fugitive.
I was immensely flattered, and I still am, to find that the whole world, really, was so much involved, so much engrossed in this series, and took it so deeply seriously, that I was forever being attacked by little old ladies in airports saying, "You rotten mean man, why don't you leave that nice Dr. Kimball alone?" And tough guys, you know, in restaurants or bars, say, "You dumb copper, don't you understand? You didn't know." They take it all very, very seriously.
Publisher and writer Tara Richter with a book club to help other writers. Does everyone have a book in them, and should it always get out?
I do believe everyone has a story to tell, and it's just about the way that you tell that story to make it, you know, obviously interesting enough to put into paper. Some of the tips that I give my authors is, you know, while you're writing your story, if it doesn't make you think really deeply, if it doesn't make you laugh, and it doesn't make you cry, then it's probably not worth putting on paper.
Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabbie, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. What does it take to be a cab driver in New York City?
The requirements have always been minimal at best. It's not like you've heard of the famous London knowledge, where you spend 2 years in some kind of silly apprenticeship until you've learned London. In New York City, if you took a test, the question would be, where's the Empire State Building? Where's Central Park? Where's Madison Square Garden? I mean, it's really not much of a test. So the running gag, of course, with cab drivers in New York is that we have very strict requirements to be a cab driver in New York. If you can breathe, you get the job.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0291 was Josh Kimmel, a talent agent with TBT Management right here in Montreal. And he's also an actor, too, and a very good one at that. Thank you very much, Josh, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A sergeant from the Santa Fe County, New Mexico Sheriff's Office is crying foul after being disciplined for having sex with a subordinate. 35-year-old Sergeant Deborah Anaya was demoted and had her pay cut, but in an appeal, argues that male deputies have sex with their other deputies on the job without punishment. So much so, she said, that it's a perk of the job. Anaya's sex wasn't even on the job. The on-duty graveyard shift commander regularly stopped by her house for some, shall we say, search and seizure when she was off duty. All she did was engage in the same conduct that the men in the department get away with all the time, said her attorney, John Day. But they decided to punish the one female supervisor in a 130-person department. Her letter of reprimand charges her with sexual misconduct, conduct unbecoming an officer, dereliction of duty, and failure as a supervisor to set an example. Yeah. Though she's great at following examples. So let me get this straight. Everybody at the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office is apparently getting some in the 130-person department, and it's all over the news now. I'm sure there are some spouses asking some pretty pointed questions right about now. And talk about a job with benefits. Yeah. Anyway, moving right along, if you listen to this show on a regular basis, then you know that everything seems to happen at Walmart. Well, here's the latest. A restroom at a Walmart in eastern Indiana has been closed indefinitely after an employee discovered a working meth lab inside. State police say a Walmart employee alerted police after seeing a man he described as suspicious enter the restroom at 11:30 p.m. with a backpack and leave without it. members of the state police meth suppression team, that's an interesting job, removed the dangerous chemicals. Delaware County Health Department inspectors closed the restroom and a nearby women's restroom until they could be decontaminated by professional cleaning companies. State police say people who make methamphetamine are leaving the deadly explosive chemicals in public places to return later to get the finished product rather than risk explosions and contamination at their own homes. Wow, things have been known to explode in public washrooms before, but it usually isn't meth. And researchers from Cornell University, inspired by the book World War Z, recently computer simulated the spread of a zombie apocalypse and now advise the anxiety-prone to head for higher ground if infections break out, recommending Glacier National Park in Montana or, even better, Alaska. Using differential equations and lattice-based models, the statisticians demonstrated that infections would slow dramatically as fewer people became available to bite, but that ultimately, we're all doomed. Now, the state most quickly wiped out, by the way? New Jersey. Wow. Is that because Governor Chris Christie keeps blocking the bridges? Yeah. The international sportswear retailer Bjorn Borg, which is the namesake of the Swedish tennis player, created a promotional video game, now also sold separately, that encourages not mayhem and murder, but the vanquishing of one's opponents with love and lovingly stripping them down so that they can be outfitted in Bjorn Borg fashions. Said a company official, a player's mission is to liberate haters by undressing them with your love guns and then to dress them in Bjorn Borg clothing. The game also features teddy bear smoke grenades and a shirtless man resembling Vladimir Putin astride a bear. Okay. I got really nothing to add to that one. It's just out there on its own, basically. And we have time for one more Stuff File news story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest segment here on the program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. When society goes out of its way to coddle and pacify next generations, you get extremely soft, malleable personalities and stories like these next two that I've put together. Story number one. Several University of Iowa students requested and received special exemption from or assistance with classwork, including exams, after complaining of stress and a loss of focus caused by the appearance of a Ku Klux Klan statue on campus in December. And story number two, as alleged de facto policy at Avalon Elementary School in Orlando, Florida, officials last year prohibited toilet flushing during the statewide Florida Comprehensive Assessment Test. It was thought, an official said, that the whooshing water sounds from nearby bathrooms would disturb the students and send their scores, according to the Orlando Sentinel reporter, spiraling down the drain. Seriously? Seriously? Are any of these kids going to be ready for the real world later in life? Me have my doubts. Anyway, time for our first guest segment here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And this time around, we're going back in our way, way back machine and playing for you something we did in the past.
This is the Stuff File.
It's time for another retro interview with a celebrity that is no longer with us. This time around, it's a chat I had back in July of 1994. Actor Barry Morse had a career that spanned seven decades, with more than 3,000 roles on radio, television, stage, and in film. He's probably best known for playing Lieutenant Gerard in the original 1960s hit series The Fugitive, starring David Janssen. And sci-fi fans knew him from his stint on Space 1999 back in the 70s. In 1994, Barry was in Montreal because he was guest starring on a new police drama called Sirens. So he dropped by into studio to chat with us, and he was the most delightful, engaging storyteller you could ever meet. In other words, a joy to be around. Here's part of that conversation now. You're here in town because you're working on an episode of Sirens, which is filming in Montreal, 22 episodes.
Yes.
And so you're back in a city that you've lived in.
Yes, it's a great sentimental journey for me, mm-hmm. Peter Anthony, because all those years ago, it's hard to believe, but in 1950, and for a part of 1951, my wife and I, and our then two toddler children, lived here mm-hmm. in Montreal, out in NDG, and just this morning, because I had a day off from shooting, I was able to make a sentimental journey down there to see if the house that we'd lived in is still there. And it is. Mm-hmm. And I was able to take some photographs to take back to my wife and our children to remind them of those very happy times that we had here. But of course, in those days, can you believe it, there was no television. And so whatever public entertainment there was all confined to the radio. Mm-hmm. And we used to pile into the old CBC studios down there on what was then Dorchester in the old Ford Hotel. And of course, all the shows were live. And I can remember vividly playing in one soap opera in English, which was called Laura Limited, and another soap opera, God forgive my nerve, in French, mm-hmm. called Un homme et son péché. And I didn't really understand much of what I was saying in Quebecois French, but all the Quebecois actors were very kind and helpful and told me how to say things. And it was a very exciting time because I was lucky enough to have been involved in television right at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. Now, most people think that television didn't begin until after the war. But in fact, the BBC in England, where I was born, had a public television service going in the latter part of 1935. And nobody who was anybody in our profession wanted to have anything to do with television. Because, can you believe this? It was commonly thought that television could never become a popular entertainment because it was very expensive. So sets cost the equivalent of, in today's terms, the equivalent of $25,000 or $30,000, let's say. And also, you couldn't get any kind of a picture if you lived more than about 2 or 3 miles from the transmitter, which meant that only very rich people living right in the middle of London could actually see the show. And those of us who were youngsters, who were trying to get our feet wet in the performing business, loved the idea of getting into this new medium.
So it's great to get on something on the ground floor, so to speak.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I remember doing a stage play with a quite famous actor of that time, and he heard that I was doing this other thing during the daytime. All the shows were live, of course, in those days, just like you and I are now. And this elder actor said to me, "What is this you're doing during the day, Morse?" And I said, "It's for the BBC, sir." We always called older actors sir in those days. He said, "Oh, yes, yes, I know. You mean the wireless." The wireless was what people called the radio, of course, in those days. And I said, "Well, no, it's not exactly the wireless, sir. It's like the wireless, but with pictures." "Oh, yes," he said with infinite scorn. He said, "You are a fool to mix yourself up with that sort of twaddle. Don't you realize," he said, "it's just a fad, like the yo-yo. They'll have forgotten all about it by Christmas." That's what people believed, that it was just a rich man's toy that would disappear. And it's amazing to realize that in that short span of time, within my lifetime, it's become one of the most important media on earth. Mm-hmm. I was telling this story. I was telling this story to some students not very long ago at the university in Toronto. And somebody said, "Well, when did you first do television?" And I said, "Well, it actually was in 1936. And they all looked terrified, these students. And I thought, well, I'll make a cheap joke. I'm a great sucker for cheap jokes. I said, yes, that's when television first began. And I should, of course, tell you that in those days," I thought, I'm going to get a cheap laugh here, "in those days, it was all done by steam." No laugh at all, because they were all writing it down. They thought it was true. I was telling the truth.
Well, you've done so much in your career, and you've done all the mediums. Do you have a preference? I know a lot of times you talk to stage actors, and they say stage is where it's at. Do you have a preference?
No. I'm lucky enough to have done and keep doing all of it. Somebody reminded me just the other day, isn't it terrifying, that I've been in this daft trade for 60 years. I call it making faces and making noises for a living. And after you've been at it that length of time, you begin to realize that they're not all that different. What is so different, of course, and what's so fascinating about radio, this thing that we're doing now, is that a great deal is left up to the audience. A great deal is left in the what we call the customer's minds. That kind of evocative thing, the way in which somebody speaks, gives an audience an opportunity to fill in the picture for themselves, doesn't it? It isn't actually all spelled out for them.
So if I speak in a very deep and menacing tone, they can visualize somebody 8 feet tall who's going to throttle you the next minute.
But if, on the other hand, I speak in a little thin, whimpery kind of voice, they can think of some little kind of nebbish fellow whom the wind can blow away. And so I think, in a way, as far as the audience's involvement is concerned, radio is almost the best of them. I still do a lot of radio. Unfortunately, there isn't a great deal of
drama or comedy,
creative radio being done nowadays. But when you think of the marvelous things that were done, I know that you're a great collector and connoisseur of all this marvelous stuff. Your customers may not know. Let me praise you for a moment. Peter Anthony and I were talking just before we came on the air, and I was staggered, being an old geezer, you know, to discover how much of the history and tradition of the whole radio field he knows about. And that's very flattering to
those of us
who are old geezers.
Let's talk a little bit about the television show, The Future, that you were on.
Oh, yeah.
What was it like being, as far as the fans are concerned, who obviously knew Mr. Kimball was innocent, being so wrong for so many years and hell-bent on proving?
Well, very encouraging. I was immensely flattered, and I still am, to find that the whole world, really, was so much involved, so much engrossed in this series, and took it so deeply seriously, that I was forever being attacked by little old ladies in airports saying, "You rotten, mean man, why don't you leave that nice Dr. Kimball alone?" And then tough guys, you know, in restaurants or bars, say, "You dumb copper, don't you understand? He didn't..." And they take it all very, very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And so when that happened, I learned that I could take refuge in the fact that I, as you can tell, I don't talk exactly like Lieutenant Gerard used to talk. And so I would say, you think I'm that chap on television? Oh, no, I'm sorry, you're wrong. I'm a professor of English at Yale, or I'd make up some story. Because, of course, it's the ultimate compliment when people take it all so seriously,
mm-hmm.
That they think it really is happening. Even to this day, I always know when some new, perhaps third world country is starting to have a television service and starting to show The Old Fugitive, because I start to get hate mail in pidgin English, you know, from Central Africa or somewhere, and people writing and saying, "Oh, why you not leave that nice man alone, you rotten fellow?"
Mm-hmm.
And it's a compliment, really, I suppose, because in those days, of course, this is the interesting thing about that series. It was so brilliantly written, of course, and that's the best part of it all. But in those days, there had not been a character like... who was the fellow who got killed on that?
David...
Not our hero. I mean, on another series later on, there was a kind of villain. Oh, gosh, I know the chap who played it. But anyway, in those days when we were doing the Fugitive, which is more than 30 years ago...
There wasn't a sort of anti-hero.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Most characters that appeared in television series were adorable, you know, almost emetically adorable, because the sponsors who backed the shows didn't want to have anybody unpleasant associated with their deodorant or motor car or whatever it was. And so it was quite a switch to have a continuing character who was deliberately designed to be upsetting. And a lot of Hollywood actors wouldn't have wanted to do it, because a lot of Hollywood actors in those days only liked playing kind of adorable parts. Well, of course, I know, and I'm sure you know, that most of the best parts to be played are the ones that are less than entirely virtuous. They're always much more interesting.
And there isn't anything such thing as a good hero without a good villain.
That's right. And when we made the pilot for that old Fugitive series, it was shown, you know, sampled around to sample audiences, and they got back to our producer, dear Quinn Martin, and people said, well, they love David Janssen, the hero, but boy, they hate that Barry Morse. You've got to get rid of him. And so Quinn would say, no, that's the whole idea. And the character I'm thinking of in the later series had initials. He was called D.T., not DJ, but TK or something around.
Thomas Ewart Edward Cat. T.H.E. Cat?
No.
Robert Loggia?
No, never mind.
Okay.
In those days, it was a new breakthrough, really, to have a continuing character who was meant to be disliked. And, of course, the flattering thing was that everybody always assumed that I was an American.
Oh, you're not talking about Dallas and J.R., are you?
That's what I...
Okay, there
yes,
you go.
Yes, I knew we'd get it. well done. Thank you, Peter Ramsey. Yeah, so it was, in its way, a kind of novelty. And the wonderful thing, the very rewarding thing, is that all over the world now, wherever I go, I run into young people who were not even born when we started to do that series, but who appreciate it and like it more than most of the new series that are on, which doesn't say much for the new series.
That was part of an interview with Barry Morse from July 1994. I could have talked to that man all night. He was a warm and kind gentleman, and the kind of person who could capture your attention with his animated joy for telling a story. Barry died on February 2, 2008, at University College London Hospital at the age of 89 from undisclosed causes. His body was donated to medical science. You can hear the full interview with Barry on my website at thestufffile.com. Click on Celebrity Audio Files, and you'll find the interview with Barry and also interviews with others. They're all listed in alphabetical order, and you can play them right off the page.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Viewer discretion is advised. But then again, why are you staring at a radio program?
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Write a Book in 4 Weeks. Plus, Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby, shares a slice of the Big Apple from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge. And we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. That's a little later on in the program. And of course, more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, The Smarter Way. Yes, the smarter way. to listen to radio. Well, Mark Rothwell made the news in Portland, Oregon in March of 2010 when he prevented a bank robbery and rescued the terrified Chase Teller by jumping the thief, knocking his gun away, and holding him until police arrived. He was later awarded a coveted Portland Police Civilian Medal of Heroism. However, on February 19th of this year, according to an arrest record, Rothwell himself pulled a gun and robbed the Albina Community Bank in Portland, making off with $15,700. Well, that certainly brings new meaning to the term breaking bad, doesn't it? And while we're on that topic, let's call this one Breaking Bad 2. For 57-year-old Arthur Mondella, a successful maraschino cherry supplier in Brooklyn, New York, the inspection by the district attorney's office in February was to be routine concerning possible pollution from local waters, or of local waters, from discharges of cherry syrup. Mondella was cooperative until the investigator discovered odd shelving attached to a wall with magnets revealing a secret room, and then the smell of marijuana, at which point Mondella calmly left the room and shot himself in the head. Ultimately, police found that the 75-year-old company was merely a side business to Mondella's substantial marijuana-growing operation in the basement. Wow, Walter White would have indeed been proud. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, here are a couple of stories that we can tag as a cavalcade of rednecks. Yeah. Number one, a 37-year-old man and two female companions were charged in February with stealing tailgates from 9 trucks in the Orlando area. Their spree ended when noticing that a club owner had offered a reward on Facebook for his branded tailgate. The three tried to sell it back to him, but botched the transaction. Yeah. Bright bunch. And number two, the driver of an empty car-carrying truck pulled off the Bishop Ford Freeway near Calumet City, Illinois, in February after he heard a calamitous sound and felt the trailer shaking violently. It turns out that 23-year-old Asa Cole, speeding and following too closely, a dangerous combination at best, had inadvertently driven his pickup truck up the low-hanging tracks of the trailer and came to a stop only inches away from the cab. Said the carrier driver, "Is this Dukes of Hazzard or something?" Yeah, Cole was cited for several violations. I bet there are stuff that he's being charged with, that are violations that are not even on the books yet. Anyway. Do you think someone shouted yee-haw during any of these stories? Yeah. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Can book clubs thrive in a digital age? That's the question we're putting to Tara Richter, who is a top-rated publisher, lifelong entrepreneur, and the author of Write a Book in 4 Weeks. Tara joins us on the line right now from Florida. Hi, Tara.
Hello.
So I'll just put the question right to you. Can book clubs thrive in a digital age?
Well, I think they can. And when you're talking about a traditional club in the sense of, you know, people reading a book and getting together and discussing it, obviously it makes it even easier because, you know, like with Kindle and digital books, so that, you know, anybody can download books to their device and they could even do, you know, virtual, you know, book clubs and like chat about it maybe on like Google Hangout or something. But what my company did is we developed a new kind of book club, which is actually a virtual book club to help aspiring authors write, publish, and market a book themselves.
So this is a book club that starts before the finished product stage then?
Exactly. What it is you sign up, and it's only $28 a month, and every month you get a manual shipped to you, and an online class emailed to you that you take from your computer that gives you all the steps of how to write, publish, and market a book yourself. So it walks you through the entire process from beginning to end.
Well, there is that old saying that everyone has a book in them, so I guess you believe in that fact. And the question I have to ask from that is, just because everyone has a book in them, should that book always always get out?
Well, that's a good question. I do believe that everyone has a story to tell. And, you know, it's just about the way that you tell that story to make it, you know, obviously interesting enough to put into paper. Some of the tips that I give my authors is, you know, while you're writing your story, if it doesn't make you think really deeply, if it doesn't make you laugh and it doesn't make you cry, then it's probably not worth putting on paper.
I guess there's also the correct motivation behind writing a book, because there are various reasons to write a book, but there are also various wrong reasons to write. I mean, for instance, if you're saying, I just want to write a book to get rich or to get famous, that's usually not going to work, is it?
No. I mean, honestly, like, when you write a book, it should be something that's like, you know, a personal goal for yourself, that you want to inspire people, that you want to help people. You know, most of the really great books were written, you know, that people wrote for themselves. It was just a passion, a desire they had within them, you know. And if you're lucky, it can become a bestseller and you can make a lot of money. But, you know, unfortunately, not every book is, of course, going to become a bestseller. So you shouldn't be banking on being able to live on the royalties from your book. It should just be kind of like, you know, another milestone in your life, a goal that you want to accomplish that makes you feel good, you know, and to get that story out there.
Writing a book can be, and in a lot of cases, is difficult. So I want to talk about the title of your book, Writing a Book in 4 Weeks. Can, to some people, sound somewhat simplistic. Are you saying that's really doable and possible? And what kind of book are we talking about?
It is. I've been doing it with my clients for years now. And basically, what it is it's just a basic algorithm. And we're talking about nonfiction here. Obviously, fiction books take a lot longer because there's story development, characters, you know, all that kind of stuff. When you're doing nonfiction, if you're just talking about, like, say, you know, like your memoirs or your business or something like that, it's more or less just a process of taking information out of your head, putting it onto paper, and organizing it. So basically, an industry standard 5x8 book, 100 pages, is approximately 20,000 words. So if you sat down and you wrote 750 words a day for 28 days, you would have a little over 20,000 words, which would be your manuscript.
Ah, okay. And the other adage that people always often talk about is, write what you know. So I'm assuming that's something you truly believe in as well.
Exactly. I mean, especially because, like, I specialize in nonfiction business books to help authors, you know, become an expert in their industry. So this is stuff that you already know. You know, if it's your life experiences, obviously you experience them, you know. If it's your business that you built, if it's processes and procedures that you've developed, that's all just information in your head. So this whole process is just to pull it out of your head and to put it on paper.
Speaking as someone in the media, there's one adage that I also know all too well. Writing the book is only part of the book. You have to promote it when it's done.
Mm-hmm. And that's the difficult part, is actually once you have the book, it's like, great, I have this book, now what do I do with it, you know? Because no one's going to buy it unless, you know, you market it and you get it out there. So that's also included in the monthly book program that I have, is all different tips and tools and online workshops to help you market the book. And, you know, if some people, if they're just not savvy enough or don't have the time to do it themselves, we do have marketing packages for our authors and anyone else that has a book out there that we can help them promote it and get the word out so we can start seeing those sales come in.
For people who are doing this, especially in this, again, digital age, there are a lot of folks who are going just the e-book route. Are you talking about that, or are you also talking about what we like to refer to as the dead tree version as well?
Within my my club and my business, we do an e-book and we also do a paperback book. Because the thing is, if you want to get on TV and radio, if you want to get, you know, that media attention out there, you have to have a physical book. Because when you're on TV, they want to hold the book. They want to take pictures of the book. You know, you want to carry the book with you wherever you go. That's your calling card. So you have to have a digital book and a paperback book. The digital book is a great, second, you know, thing in addition to having the paperback. But you definitely do have to have that paperback book published.
When somebody comes up with an idea, it's usually necessity is the mother of invention. The push comes to shove. Was there at some point in your career as a writer and a publisher that you said, you know, I've got to do this because I'm seeing far too many people make far too many mistakes?
Yeah, basically, you know, like I started writing and publishing my own books about, it's about 4 or 5 years ago. And then once I saw, you know, all these people that were trying to do books, they didn't know how to do it. They didn't know where to start. They're like, because it's a very complex process, you know, the writing and publishing and all that. And since I had figured it out, that's when, you know, I started helping other people because I wanted to see them become successful. And I, you know, wanted to share with them the secret that it's not that difficult. It's really not. It's just a process. And, you know, I streamlined the process to make it really easy for other people who have never done it before.
Is there a big difference, because a lot of times you're talking here about self-publishing as well. Is there a big difference between being just a writer and being a publisher?
You mean to be like a published author, or you mean for myself being a writer and a publisher?
For yourself, being a publisher and a writer.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, I write my own books because I just love to write. I've always loved to write. But being a publisher and, you know, and helping other authors write their books, I find great joy in that because most people are not writers. Most people are not going to sit down and write 40,000 words. They just don't have the time or they just don't have, you know, the math to do it. So, you know, with my high-end package, I actually come in, I interview the clients. I'm with a client right now. I interviewed him last Saturday for about 3 hours, and we already have a rough draft compiled, and next week we'll have like the first like draft to give back to the client. So when you come to me and I help pull this information out of your brain, we can have, you know, like a full like finished manuscript in about 2 to 3 weeks.
Wow. Okay. So a manuscript in 2 to 3 weeks, and we're talking about a book of about how long? You mentioned earlier about 100 pages.
Yeah, the books that I do are anywhere from like 100 to 200. 200 on the high end, and, you know, like 100 to 150 on average.
And what kind of range of topic matters are we talking about here? You say it's basically all nonfiction, but what are we talking about as far as the subject matters of the books?
Well, I've been working with doctors and physicians. The book I'm working on right now is the new thing out there about, like, the IV drip, where people go, like, after a hangover and get, like, the IV drip. And, you know, because you're dehydrated. So that's the book I'm currently working on right now. Some of the other books include a student loan management company that helps people, you know, manage their student loan debt. I have a professional photographer that I've published 3 books with. I mean, the topics are really endless, to tell you the truth.
Are we usually dealing with people who are professionals in a particular discipline and are applying that to a book?
Usually what I specialize in is helping the owners to write their nonfiction story in 4 weeks and publish the book in order to make them an expert in their industry. So it's really whatever business you have, you know, we'll come in and help you tell your story in the book to then publish it because, you know, once you're a business owner and you have a published book on that topic, it's going to get you on the radio, it's going to make you an expert in your industry, and it's going to give you the credibility you need to take your business to the next level.
So your book is really a calling card to what you do and makes you, like you say, an expert to the media.
Exactly. So, you know, I have, like, you know, like I said, the high-end packages where people can pay my staff and I to help them write the book, or they can sign up for the book club, which is only $20 a month. They can use all my tools, and I teach them how to do it themselves. So, and we also have, you know, the online workshops. Like next Thursday, we have a virtual workshop where anybody can attend from around the world. And if they have a finished written manuscript, they will have a published Kindle book in 2 hours at the end of the workshop.
Wow. And people can find more information by going to your website, which is richterpublishing.com, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Tara, thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
Tara Richter, author of Write a Book in 4 Weeks. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0291, and you'll find links to Tara's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRico Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Did you know that two of America's largest candy makers are being sued for failing to put labels on their candy warning about lead found in their chocolate? Sounds serious, but do we really need to worry about whether our favorite candy bar is dangerous? Well, consider this. The group suing the candy companies is using a very controversial California law known as Proposition 65. It's supposed to protect consumers by requiring labels on products containing chemicals that could cause cancer. But a major report indicates it's never done anything to lower cancer rates. The report, published in the Wall Street Journal, concluded that there isn't a single empirical study demonstrating any public health benefits of the law. What the law has done, though, is produce lots of wacky labels, like the one on a fishing lure that says, harmful if swallowed. That's right. Let's be fair. Food safety is serious, but the FDA is already charged with ensuring the safety of our food, and it says the chocolate is safe. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents the Gabby Cabby, direct from his yellow mobile conveyance lounge in the city that never sleeps, New York. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, fresh from the Big Apple, here he is, Mr. Franklin. That's Peter Franklin, the Gabby Cabby. Hello, sir.
Hello, hello, live from the streets of New York where I am fresh.
Now, you sent an email out to several people. I was one of the lucky ones to get it, where you talked about becoming a New York cab driver. Now, let me quote the email here. You said, before any dope can be an NYC taxi driver, now it is going to get even easier than that. If you are a jerk who knows nothing about NYC, please apply immediately. You will not believe the new requirements. So I've got to ask, what are the new requirements?
Well, okay, the requirements have always been minimal at best, okay? It's not like you've heard of the famous London knowledge, where you spend 2 years in some kind of silly apprenticeship until you've learned London. In New York City, you merely, you know, if you took a test, the question would be, where's the Empire State Building? Where's Central Park? Where's Madison Square Garden? I mean, it's really not much of a test. So the running gag, of course, with cab drivers in New York is that we have very strict requirements to be a cab driver in New York. If you can breathe, you get the job.
Okay, so are you saying now that it's become even easier than that?
Yeah, well, it's going to be even easier, and the reason for that is they figure every cab driver is running around with a GPS thing, which they are not, by the way. So that's just a bunch of rubbish. But they're just saying that, well, why do you have to know where anything is? If you get into my cab and you say Penn Station, all I got to do is poke in the numbers, and it's going to automatically take us to Penn Station. Well, you know, in the good old days, when I first started driving a cab on the streets of New York, it was kind of nice if you knew the city, because maybe I might talk to you as we were driving along and point out to you that there's Madison Square Garden, which, by the way, is not square, it's round. And there's Penn Station, which they ripped down, okay? Thank goodness they didn't rip down Grand Central. You know, you get a little narrative, only if I sense you're in the mood for it. But I don't know, getting into a New York City cab in the near future, and you giving the address to the cab driver and him punching it in, well, you can kiss that relationship goodbye.
Yes, and I don't know if you've ever watched Amazing Race on television, but it seems to be that no matter what part of the world somebody goes in, they're always thwarted by the taxi driver who doesn't know where he or she is going.
Well, yeah, but that's to be expected in New York City, but now don't make it even worse, you know.
Which brings me to a question I don't think I've ever asked you, and it's timely. How do you, a registered New York taxi driver, feel about Uber?
Doesn't affect us in any way. And the reason for that is it's affecting people who are stupid enough to work for them. And let me explain that to you in a second. But I'll give you the background on our industry. There are approximately 13,000 yellow cabs on the streets of New York. That's the same number of cabs that we had back in 1938. So in other words, the market has increased, but we haven't. And that's been because the industry has kept pretty much of a tight hold. The only way you could get a cab today would be to buy it from somebody who already had it. Well, but you're getting into the cab, you give the cab driver money, and that's the end of your relationship. Well, that's not one of the things that's happening with Uber. First of all, Uber's rates fluctuate, which I think is absolutely insane. And in addition to that, they're paying by credit card, which means the driver may have to wait 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 days before he's ever going to see the money. And sometimes he doesn't see the money because there's something wrong with the credit card, et cetera, et cetera. So Uber's arrival in New York City is really much ado about nothing. It's a novelty. People have gone running to it. But I predict with all the things that the city is chasing after them, I don't think they're going to be around in New York City very long.
Mm. Now, one of the things that I caught my eye was a story I had seen in the papers a little while ago about a guy using the HOV lanes and having a person beside him who was not living.
Yeah, well, you're supposed to have three people in a car. So the guy is speeding and the cop pulls him over. And what does he discover? But there is a real live driver, but sitting next to him is a wooden dummy, and sitting in the back seat is a wooden dummy. You know, if he hadn't been speeding, the cop wouldn't have stopped him, and he probably would have got away with his little, trick there, but he didn't get away with it. And I got to tell you something. It reminds me of the time that somebody died in my cab, and I pulled over to the nearest police station. And I went inside and I said, you know, there's a dead guy in my cab. And the cops said, oh, yeah? And they came out and they took a look and I said, sure enough, cabbie, the guy is dead. How did you know he was dead? I said, well, he wasn't laughing at my jokes. Which is a true story. So that was kind of made me think of that. You know, I guess the cop might have asked these two people a few things and they didn't answer.
Hmm. Interesting indeed. Now, let's talk about the mayor of New York, because you often have an opportunity when you talk about the mayor of New York. By the way, you're not usually very, shall we say, kind to the mayor, your current mayor, Bill de Blasio.
Well, I don't like the guy because he's a phony liberal. He talks a good game.
Okay.
And in reality, he isn't. He's a fat cat like all the rest of them. At least the rest of the fat cats act like fat cats. And almost brag that they are fat cats. He's constantly talking about how he's going to make the city equal, and it's no longer going to be two New Yorks, meaning a rich New York and a poor New York. He's going to alter all of humanity. It's never going to be even for everybody. So stop telling everybody that.
Okay, so what is this recent story dealing with the upcoming St. Paddy's Day parade?
Okay, this is this baloney with the gay thing. For years, every time we get near to the parade, which is going to be on March 17th, there's a whole controversy as to whether or not gays are going to be able to march in the parade. The parade is run by the Ancient Order of the Hibernians. I think you have to be 96 to be in it. It's a bunch of old Irish guys. Now, their attitude is they don't care who marches in their parade, but you're not going to march with a sign saying what your product is, what your religion is, even though everybody is presumably Catholic, what your sexual persuasion is, what your color is, although that's pretty obvious. You can march in the parade. So that's a very important distinction, which every year when this controversy starts, the media likes to play up, gays forbidden to march in parade. No, they're not. Everybody has the same requirement. They're not running an advertisement for any group or persuasion or what have you. And I guarantee you that 99% of the real gays in New York City understand that completely and couldn't care less. So what does this mayor do? This dope. He announces he's not going to march in the parade because of the prejudice of the parade towards gay, which is a complete misstatement.
Is there anybody, especially after what the comments he made about police officers when there was the which led to the shooting of two police officers, although I'm not necessarily connecting one to the other, many in the police department will, but is there anybody who's still on his side after some of the comments he's made?
Yeah, because there's a lot of people who dislike the cops, and the thing for that is, excuse me, that was another indication, another instance where the media and politicians took advantage of it. Look, the cop that killed the guy in Staten Island would have killed the guy if he had been white. As a matter of fact, if it had been his mother, he would have killed him. He wasn't a very nice guy. But it had absolutely nothing to do with race. And as a matter of fact, even the black guy's wife said it had nothing to do with race. And yet de Blasio, our mayor, turned it into a racial thing in which he had to announce to the world that because his wife is black, it's a mixed marriage, the kids, he has a son and a daughter, are, I don't know, what you say, half white, half black?
No, half black, half white.
Whatever. They're half. Who knows what they are? Why don't they make up their mind and get one color rather than causing all this confusion, right?
Yeah.
I think I'm going to start a movement. Everybody has to be one color, and that's it. Look at the president of the United States. What the hell is he?
Beige.
Right? No, I mean, seriously. Make up your mind, Obama. But anyway, be that as that may, he then announced, talk about being, I'm talking about de Blasio, he announced that he warned his children, especially his son, to be very careful and be afraid of white cops. Now, first of all, the mayor's son doesn't have to worry about anything because he's walking around with two bodyguards. And second of all, even if you said that to the kid, and I can understand that, you don't announce it on television and say, hey, I told my kid to be afraid of white cops. So the white cops were fit to be tied. And since they have their agendas, they took that football and ran with it to make a big thing. And you want to hear a funny coincidence? They just all got a raise in salary. And they must be laughing up their sleeves because de Blasio got so intimidated by their hysteria about that stupid remark, he gave them everything they wanted at the bargaining table. And I had predicted it. I said it's nothing more than a way to get more money out of the city.
And, you know, we've run out of time, which means we can't talk about the fact that murders are down in New York City. And having said that, people could always go to your website and find out more information about getting tours.
They certainly should, and thank you very much.
People can go to your website, which is www.gabby.com, and they can send you an email to peter@gabby.com. And once again, sir, I thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. We do have an idiot of the day coming your way in just a matter of moments, but I do have one more Stuff File news story to share with you right here, right now, on a program. You know what I'm going to say. That's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. 43-year-old Ralph Curry had an issue with his Delco, Pennsylvania apartment, but he was unable to get in contact with building maintenance. He apparently thought that the issue required immediate attention and had to be done somehow, some way soon, and he needed to figure out how to get that done. He says to himself, self, I'm going to clog the toilet with potatoes and have that overflow, and I'll call maintenance again. This is a quote from Police Superintendent Michael Chitwood. It's unknown how many potatoes Curry flushed down the toilet, but they caused an overflow. When maintenance still didn't respond, Curry allegedly pulled the building's fire alarm, causing 12 families in other units to evacuate into the 28-degree Fahrenheit weather, where they had to wait 30 minutes before being allowed back inside. Curry was arrested and charged with making false alarms to agencies of public safety, recklessly endangering another person, and disorderly conduct. Well, his new residence will have a fully functioning toilet right next to his bed. Yeah. I was toying with the idea. Toying, mind you, just mildly toying with the idea of giving him the idiot of the day. But I did not. But since you've all waited very patiently on this program, now, boys and girls, this is the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
A South African TV journalist was mugged on camera seconds before he was due to deliver a live report outside a hospital. The SABC news camera recorded the two men approaching Vuyo Mvoko outside a Johannesburg hospital while he was preparing to deliver a report on Zambia's president arriving at the facility for some tests. It was like seconds to air, and then the commotion started. I couldn't understand why they'd walk right in front of the camera, because the light is on, and they could see that, and our car is branded so they could see that this is a live broadcast, Mvoko told the BBC. Mvoko said the robbers demanded he hand over his phone. They then also took another phone and a laptop computer from the news crew. Two men have since been arrested. Two other suspects were arrested for buying stolen goods, including laptops belonging to SABC TV. One suspect is still on the run. Now, I already have experience with many dim-witted individuals while trying to do live TV reports, but I have to ask the question anyway. Why, oh why, oh why, would anyone attempt to rob a television reporter on live TV with a signal that is beaming back to the control room and not even think twice about hiding their faces? And by the way, you can go online and see the video. I'll even put the link in there for you so you can check it out. Well, one reason and one reason only. They're idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0291. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0291. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Getting Jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mama jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.